Tonight I have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Pierre Gassman, who will deliver a lecture entitled The Global War on Terror and the Humanitarian Role. Born in Switzerland, Mr. Gassman has spent more than 20 years working for the Geneva-based International Committee of the Red Cross, promoting their mission to, and I quote, protect the lives and dignity of victims of war and internal violence and provide them with assistance. Most recently, Mr. Gassman served as the head of the delegation of the ICRC in Baghdad, Iraq from July 2003 to July 2004. He has also been the head of operations for the ICRC in Eastern Europe, drafted contributions to the UN Secretary General's Millennium Report, and was head of the ICRC delegation in Bogota, Colombia from 1996 to 1999. The mission of the Vanderbilt University Speakers Committee is to encourage thoughtful reflection and dialogue on contemporary issues in order to promote and strengthen the intellectual environment at Vanderbilt. Mr. Gassman's lecture is based on his extensive personal experiences while serving on behalf of the International Committee of the Red Cross. We believe his perspective will deepen this community's understanding of the realities of the global war on terror and how humanitarian organizations play a needed role in minimizing its tragic realities. Following Mr. Gassman's speech, there will be a question and answer period. I encourage you all to take advantage of this opportunity, as well as reflect on the images being displayed in the lobby as you exit the auditorium. That said, it is my pleasure to give you Mr. Pierre Gassman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much to Abby Seidel for having organized this event. Thank you all for coming here tonight despite the rain, and I understand some parking problems in the area. And also a great thanks to my friend Fred Clark. Fred Clark is the photographer that is showing his pictures outside in the hall. I met Fred in 1998 in Colombia when he was on a tour on behalf of the ICRC to photograph victims of war. At that time, we had organized a huge consultation of people in war areas called the Voices of War. We wanted to know what people thought about humanitarian action, and Fred has been instrumental in documenting this great undertaking. You can find, actually, on the internet, there's a site that is called Voices of War, where you find all the comments made by the people in a variety of circumstances and war-affected countries about what they thought about the application of international humanitarian law, about rules of war in their own context. Now, the theme tonight is global war on terror, humanitarian action. Basically, if you look at terrorism per se, nothing much has changed with 9/11. Terrorism has been with us for a long time. You had actually, in the 1980s, a war on terrorism declared by President Reagan. You had also on the humanitarian side something that has been touted as novel today, humanitarian intervention. Basically, President Carter's foreign policy was determined also by humanitarian human rights concerns. So there is nothing much new in the relationship between the war on terror and humanitarian action. However, I think that 9/11 has changed very fundamentally one aspect of things, and that is that instead of fighting terrorism with a law enforcement effort on an international basis with international cooperation between states, the United States government and its allies have declared a military intervention against terrorism. And it's in the name of that military intervention against international terror that they have declared the global war on terror, with the consequent interventions, the military interventions in Afghanistan and namely in Iraq. Now, that intervention has created a lot of concern amongst the humanitarian community. The humanitarian and the human rights community is now looking at the perception of states with regard to the global war on terror. And it sees that states are now saying, especially the United States and the United Kingdom, are saying that this is not a war between states. It is not either a civil war, yet they have declared war on terror. They say that the global war on terror has no definite timeline. It's not going to end with an international agreement. There is no idea of a settlement of the dispute with the terrorists that they are trying to combat. They are saying that there are no more legitimate combatants except those that are really fighting terrorism. They are saying that those who are not with us are against us. These are the very words of President Bush. So what they're saying is that there is no choice of anyone between one side or the other, or there's no room in the middle for anyone to maneuver and to say, I'm not with either of you. I am trying to do something that implies that I'm not taking sides with any one of you. So there is no more room for this. It has been said by Secretary Powell, namely, that humanitarian action has become a force multiplier or of military action. And if you look at the United States security strategy of 2002, and if you look at the European security strategy of last year and a confirmation of that strategy at the beginning of this year, you will find that humanitarian action, development, international cooperation has become a pillar of the war against terror, of the global war against terror. And finally, what the humanitarian community and human rights activists see today is that the military are now running a large part of humanitarian aid. They are the determining factor, namely in Iraq, for deciding what is being done in terms of reconstruction and development. And most of those aid programs are now being run through the Pentagon. USAID and the international agencies and national agencies that do work with the US government in the Iraqi context are basically reporting back to the Pentagon via the until June 30th, they worked through the provisional coalition authority, and now they're working through the embassy and through a number of institutions that have been created especially after June 30th in order to continue to streamline the international aid effort of the coalition and namely of the United States. So the humanitarian community has some worries about that, and for this community, the war, the global war on terror, has also changed a number of perceptions and has created a number of fears. And what they're feeling now, especially after the bombing of 19th August of the UN compound in Baghdad, where Sergio Vieira de Mello, the UN Secretary General Special Representative, died, and where more than 20 other people were killed and where scores, dozens of people were wounded. And then, as in the aftermath, on the 27th of October, when the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross headquarters in Baghdad, was attacked, where two of our people died and where 12 other people died in the street, we have realized, the humanitarian community has realized, that we are no longer immune to the acts of war, and we can no longer pretend that we are something that is apart and some institutions that can operate freely within that context. Generally speaking, the humanitarian community is now expressing that it can no longer assume that it is going to be perceived as neutral within the global war on terror. It is also perceiving that it is no longer independent or perceived as independent from the donor community. It realizes that it's becoming subordinated to the broader goals of the coalition against terror. It now has to compete for funds with the military. It can no longer assist impartially people in accordance with their needs, but it must now first serve those who are designated as beneficiaries by the military coalition. And finally, and most importantly, the humanitarian community and human rights activists are seeing that the global war on terror is questioning the applicability of international humanitarian law and of human rights. And what they're saying is that the anti-terrorism campaign could well threaten the fundamental restraints on the conduct of warfare and could weaken the protection and assistance to which civilians in war are entitled. Now, before we go into the analysis of these fears of the humanitarian community, let me walk you quickly through the framework of humanitarian activities and warfare in the Cold War period and then in the 90s. And especially looking at the legal framework within which warfare was being done and within which humanitarian activities could be implemented. And also looking at some of the realities in funding and of the scope of humanitarian activities in the Cold War period and in the 90s. Basically, in the Cold War period, the law that was applicable to humanitarian action and to war was international humanitarian law, the four Geneva Conventions, plus from 1977, two protocols additional that were crafted by states with the participation of a lot of legal experts and also, interestingly, with the participation of revolutionaries and guerrillas from all over the world that actually could chip in the crafting of these conventions. Those two additional protocols are particularly interesting because they try to remedy something that international humanitarian law does not seem to foresee and does not seem to cover, which is wars for the liberation of peoples and wars against apartheid, and especially the cover of non-international armed conflict, that is, civil wars. If you look at the Geneva Conventions, these are conventions that are applicable to international armed conflict. And basically, during the Cold War years, humanitarian agents could only work within two essential constraints. One of the constraints is in the UN Charter, and that constraint says no other states and no organization can interfere in the internal affairs of any one other state. And the second constraint, you find it in the prevailing international humanitarian law, namely in the Geneva Convention. Whenever there is an obligation imposed on the belligerents to provide security, to provide assistance to civilians, to victims of war, most of these obligations of the belligerents are coming with an addendum that says, under the proviso that military necessity so permits. And this notion of military necessity has been, during the Cold War, one of the main arguments for many states to say that humanitarian organizations couldn't go anywhere or they couldn't work under these circumstances, they couldn't access a war zone, it was too dangerous, and the military necessity required that one had to wait or one couldn't get any assistance through to civilian populations. I have lived through a number of circumstances in the Cold War period, namely in the proxy wars of the Cold War in Mozambique and in Angola, where it was extremely difficult to argue with the governments concerned that we wanted to go through and we wanted to attend to the needs of civilian populations that were under the control of the opposition forces, that is UNITA in Angola and RENAMO in Mozambique, simply because the government said that even talking to these people was an actual interference into their in their sovereignty, that it was violating their sovereignty to assume that these people were legitimate discussion partners, that we would, by working with them, we would confer on them an illegitimate a status as a combating force, and that status did not figure in international humanitarian law. So it was extremely difficult for humanitarian organizations to operate during the Cold War period, especially in the conflicts where the two blocs were opposed against each other. And in these circumstances, it was particularly important that humanitarian organizations were very insistent and very compliant with three basic principles that are today the mainstay, the main fundamental principles of humanitarian action in the world. And these three principles are, and you hear this all the time, and nowadays everybody has adopted them, are, first of all, neutrality. Today, anyone doing a humanitarian job or any human rights advocate would say that when he is doing something in favor of people that are affected by excesses of warfare or political violence, they do this neutrally. They are not taking sides on the political end, but they do this only to help the people on the ground, and that they are not involved in any political controversy. Somehow today, this is certainly less true than it used to be during the Cold War period, and during the Cold War period, very few people in the humanitarian world would actually get involved in this kind of controversies, except if they were practically used as instruments by either of the two parties. I think the United States, Western governments, have often used human rights, have often used humanitarian law as an argument to demonstrate that the Soviet Union and its allies did not respect human rights in their own realm. And on the other hand, the Soviet Union and its allies have always used human rights and the argument of the sovereignty of the state in order to impede any intervention in the internal affairs of their own states. So human rights was not something that you could really work with internationally. And you could only base your activity on the fact that you were really neutral,
You did not take political sides. You did not participate in the political controversy between one bloc or the other. The second principle that is very important is the principle of independence. And that means that any humanitarian organization that works is not beholden to any donor, for example, or is not beholden to any politically oriented constituency. And that, at that time, at least in the Cold War, was extremely important because there were human rights organizations. There are organizations that have their own constituencies, namely religious organizations, that were pretty vocal about one side or the other. And if you wanted to intervene, for example, you wanted to do something in Angola, Mozambique, but even in civil wars in other countries, in Africa, for example, or in Latin America, you had to be able to demonstrate that you were really independent of any of those constituencies, be that governments or international organizations or a private group of donor constituents in any given country. If you didn't do that, you probably had to choose whether you worked only on the government side or only on the rebel side. And for example, in El Salvador, it was very typical that the only organization that was able at that time to work on both sides of the political spectrum, that was able to access both rebel-held territories and government-held territories, was the International Committee of the Red Cross, that strictly abided by these principles of neutrality and independence. The third key principle of humanitarian action that is still prevailing today, and I believe that it is the most important one, especially considering that the two other principles are today put in question, namely by the global war on terror, is the principle of impartiality. And that simply says that whatever you do in the field, whenever you go out there and help, you provide help in accordance with needs and not in accordance with race, creed, sex, or whatever type of constituency that would differentiate one person from the other. And that principle is certainly the one that is the most important for all organizations, whether they do have a political opinion, whether they do have a political constituency. As long as they go out there, and when they help, they do help impartially, I think that is fulfilling a large part of the humanitarian commitment that they have. Now, with regard to the scope of humanitarian action, what you have to say is that during the time of the Cold War, the scope of humanitarian action was perceived as being very limited. It was essentially emergency food aid, it was emergency medical aid, it was providing drinking water and maybe prosthesis to people that had been amputated or mine victims or what have you, but it was essentially survival aid. That has then considerably changed in the 90s. We will come to that. Now, on the legal side, at that time, as I said, application of international humanitarian law, human rights law pretty much out of the picture, at least in wartime situation, it was accepted that human rights law did not apply, that humanitarian law was applicable to conflicts, and that there could be exceptions, that human rights could be suspended in conflict situations. That argument is not over. It's still being used, for example, in Colombia, where the Colombian government is always struggling, for example, with the notion whether it should instate a state of emergency that would allow it to suspend a certain number of civil liberties under the pretense that it is actually waging a war against the FARC guerrillas or against the ELN. And say that the notion of whether it can actually suspend these civil liberties or not has even gone to the Human Rights Court in Costa Rica. There have been some decisions where some of the constitutional provisions of the Colombian constitution have been put in question also by Colombian courts, and where some of the legislation is being very hotly debated in Colombia itself, and where it's always an electoral argument. I think President Uribe has succeeded now in pushing through the faculty to have a certain suspension of civil liberties so that he, in his view, can wage the war against the FARC guerrillas. Again, when I say that this law was applicable, I'm not saying that it was truthfully applied by all states. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that most states, especially those states embroiled in civil war, they did reject the applicability of international humanitarian law. And when I said that in 1997, you had these new protocols about the international armed conflicts, and in a way the justification that people who were fighting against apartheid and people who were fighting against colonial rule had a certain status, a special status as combatants. That was hotly debated, and there are a number of countries that have never ratified these two additional protocols, amongst them the United States. There is still a very celebrated lawyer in the Department of Defense who keeps saying that the United States should not ratify these treaties precisely because they confer a special status to people who are fighting against colonial oppression and fight against apartheid regimes, because he says that that would imply then in any kind of so-called just war declared by any kind of rebel group in any country, provided that was done for political reasons, these people would then legitimately be able to attack the legitimate government and the legitimate armed forces. And basically what the United States wants is to be able to differentiate and to have this law enforcement approach against people that it considers as terrorists, also in those circumstances. So basically, international law didn't have much of an impact until the end of the 80s. At the end of the 80s, in El Salvador, the Duarte government recognized that the second protocol that was concerning civil wars was actually applicable to the Salvadoran context. He did that for political reasons, presumably, because he thought that if he could get the guerrillas around the table, he could negotiate a peace settlement. And the guerrillas, they probably thought that if they declared that, yes, they would abide by the provisions of this protocol, they would gain political status. And this is basically what happened, and that is what then has led to the possibility of the Duarte government to conclude some agreements with the FMLN. Now, during the 90s, all that has considerably changed. If you look at the, obviously that has to do with the end of the Cold War. If maybe a last look at funding, if you look at the way humanitarian action was funded during the Cold War, there was very little. There were a few organizations. There wasn't much that was being done. You had in the mid-70s an official sort of bilateral and multilateral humanitarian aid that was reaching something like $50 million. And by the mid-80s, that had reached something like $500 million, especially with the Ethiopian famine that drew a lot of funds from international donors. And by the end of the 80s, we were reaching something like $1 billion in humanitarian aid. That has had mostly to do with the Somali intervention in 1991. But what really came through in the 1990s was that there were a number of international human rights groups that considered that looking at the past and looking at the applicability of international humanitarian law, they thought that this was sort of outdated and it wasn't applied anyway, and basically it was legitimating war. So everybody that was sort of on the pacifist side, and many human rights organizations are on that side, they felt that a law that was basically regulating war was a law that was legitimizing war. So it's like if you have a code for a driving code, for example, they would say that if you had a driving code that was forbidding a number of things that you could not do, that was actually permitting these things to be done. So it, in my view, this is a totally erroneous assessment to say that if there is a law, that law basically legitimizes what it does forbid. But that was the main opinion, the main trend of opinion amongst human rights groups with respect to international humanitarian law. And what the paradigm that came through really in the 90s was the paradigm of human security. That is something that would encompass security concerns of individuals with development concerns. And people would say, the human rights advocates and the human security advocates, what they're saying is that you cannot look just at the security needs of individuals, which is what international humanitarian law basically does, but you have to look also at all their other needs that cover needs for their livelihood and needs for their survival, and also for their personal dignity, their personal development. And that paradigm that was encompassing all rights by any individual was also accompanied by that movement for globalization. And basically you had a creation of an international civil society that was advocating the promotion of human security, and that was acting as if it could actually influence states to adopt new policies and to respect human rights, rather than have individual nations, nation states, see to it that they would apply international humanitarian law. In a way, they are right, because if you look at international humanitarian law, there is a provision in the Geneva Conventions that says that the state's party to this convention, to every one of these conventions, is not only obligated to respect the convention when it wages war, but it is also obligated to see to it that these conventions are applied by all the other signatory states. And if you look at the history of international humanitarian law, since 1949, that provision has never been invoked by any state to convince another state to actually apply the laws in situations of warfare. So the accusations of human rights groups and then of the French doctors, you will remember that in the late 80s, the French doctors actually pleaded for humanitarian intervention, for the right to interference, because they felt that if you continue to apply that principle of non-interference, if you continue to accept the notion of military necessity, that was simply not sufficient to protect civilian populations from the excesses of warfare, and that you had to establish a right by human rights groups, by humanitarian groups, to move into any kind of situation and to see to it that human rights were applied and that they could provide the humanitarian assistance that people needed. So this is sort of the broad legal context of the 90s. And you had it during the 90s, of course, also a very strong development of more human rights law. The Genocide Convention, the Convention for the Protection of Women's Rights, the Convention for Civilian and Political Rights, and so on. So there was a very strong movement to establish a rights-based basis, that is, to establish a basis where you could argue that every individual, wherever it was, had rights that any state had to protect, and that the international civil rights movement, that the international civil society that's been established with the huge network of the internet and with thousands of NGOs that emerged from this movement, that they must take a huge influence on government decisions. And basically governments, Western governments in particular, have very much yielded to that kind of pressure. And in fact, there has been a conjunction of interests in a sense that on the one hand, you have the movement towards globalization, the abolishing of international borders for trade, for commerce, for finance. And by the same token, you have also that international human rights movement that sort of compounds the economic opening and the abolishing of borders and a certain undermining of the notion of the nation state that will protect exclusively its own security and its own sovereignty. And what added, say, to the confusion, if I may say so, was that many human rights organizations, as they saw that they could not achieve in every instance what they wanted to achieve, namely the protection of civilians and the protection of populations and the provision of humanitarian aid, what they said was that governments, especially Western governments and the United Nations and a variety of military alliances, had to intervene to stop militarily, to stop excesses of political violence or excesses of abuses against human rights that were happening in a variety of states. And what you saw during the 90s was that the conflicts in Somalia, in Bosnia, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, in Kosovo, and then even in Afghanistan, and now to a certain extent also in Iraq, have been justified on humanitarian grounds and on the grounds that human rights of people had to be protected by that intervention. I think the argument has been used, not extensively, also by the United States government, by the British government, to justify, to a certain extent, their interventions in Afghanistan and in Iraq. On the scope side of what humanitarian organizations were going to do, in parallel to that new paradigm of human security, humanitarian organizations, or the notion of humanitarianism, has greatly expanded. Now humanitarian organizations are doing practically everything. It's not only emergency aid. Now there is the idea that even in war-type situations, you cannot just provide emergency assistance. You also have to think about reconstruction and development. And what is happening is that most agencies active today are either active, not on, they're not only active in the provision of emergency aid. If they're large agencies, they will now do everything. They will do emergency assistance, they will do reconstruction, they will do development, and they're even branching out, and this is really sort of one of the most interesting aspects of things, they're branching out in conflict resolution, in conflict prevention, and so on and so forth. So they're branching out into distinctly political aspects of the way societies are organized in war-affected countries. And you could see that, if, for example, even the UN Secretary General has stated that he felt that the NGOs had now a very important role to play, namely because they knew much better than international organizations or that states that were intervening the people on the ground, and that they could much better anticipate what was going on. They had much better information, assuming that international human rights organizations and international humanitarian organizations were connected with organizations in the war-affected countries, which is not necessarily true. If you look at reality, you will find that most international organizations today are still suffering from the fact that they're acting like paramilitary organizations in a way. I'm now really caricaturing in a way. Because they are moving, when there is an emergency, everybody is moving in at the same time. You bring in a lot of expats, you bring in a lot of stuff to get the expats to survive in a difficult environment. And when the emergency is sort of over, or when it's out of fashion, the expats will all move out. And what they will have left is not necessarily a fully empowered, fully competent local organization that could actually pick things up and could move into the reconstruction and development. And there is also this aspect of what we currently call, or what's commonly called, mission creep. People start doing emergency aid, and then they get sort of gradually, the conflicts are protracted in many African countries today, in Latin America, Colombian conflict. These are protracted conflicts. These conflicts are going on since many years, and they're not going to stop immediately, whatever you do. And of course, people think that if we are in there, we cannot just, at the peak of some emergency, provide some emergency aid. If we want to stay and if we want to get integrated into the local societies, we have to stay longer. We have to learn, and we have to cooperate with local staff to be able to go into reconstruction and development. And fortunately, all these promises of empowerment, of creating local relays, have not really happened. And if you look at the way international humanitarian aid is still provided today, it's one of the big, big issues that has to be corrected. So the 90s, in a summary, the 90s have given us a new context, in a sense that humanitarian organizations, human rights organizations became extremely powerful. They felt very powerful. They felt that they had the right and the duty to defend civilians in war. They were successful in generating new international legislation, and they were becoming involved en masse in all these conflicts that I've cited before. And a new element into that that came into that was when they were asking for international military intervention, they were actually asking for this international military humanitarian intervention on the grounds that the Geneva Conventions state that it is the duty of governments that are intervening to provide humanitarian aid. For example, the United States, as an occupying power in Iraq, according to the Geneva Conventions, has the obligations to provide basic security and basic services to the civilian population in Iraq. That's an obligation. And humanitarian institutions have been insistent that states do that, and when they asked for international intervention to provide a safeguard against excesses of abuses by the regimes that they wanted to change or that they wanted to counter in their humanitarian wars, These regimes, NATO, all the groups that were intervening in Kosovo, in Somalia, and so on, then became responsible for providing that aid. And as they intervened militarily, there had to be a new kind of cooperation between humanitarian organizations and the military. And all these wars during the 90s have been sort of a testing ground of that new type of cooperation between the military and humanitarian organizations. And in a way, humanitarian organizations have become very, they have been complaining bitterly about the fact that the military are taking too much space. Although they were the first ones to call for military intervention against the excesses by the powers that were abusing civil, human rights, and while they were saying that the authorities that were in place, the powers that be, were responsible for providing the necessary basic services and the protection of the civilian population, when the military and the intervening governments actually did that themselves, the humanitarian community was very confused and still is confused because it, in a way, it doesn't like that because it does infringe on the privileges that it thought it had acquired during the 90s. So in most of these conflicts in the 90s, we have the NGOs and international humanitarian institutions have kept insisting on the roles as monitors of state responsibilities to provide basic services. And we have seen military cooperation in a way that we thought that the military have to do three things and nothing more. They have to foster a secure environment for civilians and for the humanitarian agencies. Second, they have to support the protection and assistance work of the agencies, for example, with logistics. It was perfectly accepted and is still accepted that the military would fly in the goodies and that the humanitarian organizations would then handle the distribution. And thirdly, and only exceptionally, should the military actually proceed directly with distributing and providing assistance to the civilian populations. And even you find that notion of the exclusive of the international humanitarian organizations for aid to civilians, even in a note in a NATO instruction that says that civic action activities by the military are to be limited to exceptional circumstances, and they should be undertaken only in collaboration with humanitarian agencies and civil authorities. So to sum up, humanitarian organizations in the 90s, human rights organizations have become a force that has largely influenced at least the discourse of foreign policy, including military interventions, both bilateral, multilateral, with or without UN backing or implication. It now encompasses everything from emergency aid to peace building. There is a very vocal international civil society that is asserting its right and duty to protect human security and that wants to defend its independence from governments and intergovernmental institutions. It wants to be able to intervene directly in conflict situations without being in any way identified with the intervening states and organizations, and it doesn't want to be identified with the military, and it wants to be able to independently monitor the application of human rights and humanitarian law. The same international civil society that claims for all these privileges and rights is still very much dependent for its financing from the governments that it is actually criticizing. And the same civil society demands from the intervening military that they provide protection for its activities and that they establish this independent humanitarian space for them to work. Now let's go back to the original complaints that I cited in the beginning, complaints about the international humanitarian law and human rights community, about what the global war on terror has really changed in their ability to operate independently, neutrally, and impartially within the contexts that are affected by the global war on terror. First, let's look at the assertion that we can no longer assume that humanitarian action is neutral. It is probably to a large extent true, at least for Western humanitarian organizations, especially within the context of the global war on terror. Fundamentalist Islamic organizations view international NGOs as the humanitarian arm of the intervening forces. If you look at the UN, the UN has, even though it may have passed over that notion of non-intervention into the internal affairs of state, the UN has a problem because it is a complete mix of organizations that do peacemaking, peacekeeping, that do reconstruction and development, and that do, on the other hand, humanitarian aid. And the perception of what the UN is, whether it is really truly neutral in the contexts which are affected by the global war on terror, is, of course, that it is not. We will come to, if you look at Iraq, for example, during the 90s, the UN had to do weapons inspections. They had to control ceasefire lines. They were managing the oil and food program that was largely perceived as a spoliation of the Iraqi people by most of the Iraqis because they saw that a lot of people were getting rich on the back of the Iraqis, and a lot of people were making a lot of money with the Iraqi oil while the population was suffering from the sanctions regime. The UN was implementing the sanctions. So the Iraqis feel that basically there is no difference between a UN that is providing humanitarian aid and election assistance and a UN that has been doing all these things throughout the years. And when the UN was bombed on 19th August 2003, the terrorist group allied to Al-Qaeda that then made a comment, issued a communique claiming responsibility for the bombing, they argued in detail why they had chosen the UN as target. And they very specifically asserted that the UN, under no circumstances, and considering what they had done in Iraq during the 90s, and the way that they were allied with the United States in a variety of other conflicts that the Western world, the allies of the United States, were waging, it could not be considered as neutral, and that therefore they considered the UN as part and parcel of the Western alliance and of Western imperialism. A number of NGOs now within, we're still talking about the issue whether we can still be perceived as neutral. If you look at the Iraqi and the Afghan context, a number of humanitarian NGOs and human rights groups now have to operate for security reasons with escorts provided by the coalition forces. It's obvious that the perception by the civilians in Iraq and by the opposition in particular to the occupation and to the new government is that all those organizations that are working under the direct protection of military forces that are part of the coalition forces or of the multinational force now are part of the enemy, and that they consider them as part and parcel of these occupying forces. On the funding side, we talked about the independence, the issue that we can no longer credibly claim that the humanitarian organizations in particular are independent. The truth of the matter is that there are many more humanitarian organizations that are operating. Budgets have multiplied. We now have a humanitarian aid budget that is given bilaterally and multilaterally of something like $6 billion U.S. dollars as compared to about $1 billion at the beginning of the 90s. Much of that money that humanitarian organizations use, private organizations and government-sponsored organizations and intergovernmental organizations or international organizations, including the ICRC, do receive most of their money from governments. And especially because they're not only doing emergency humanitarian work, they're not just providing emergency aid, but because they have branched out in things that cost a lot of money, like reconstruction and development. So it's very difficult to argue today to any faction implied in the global war on terror that the international humanitarian organizations, or at least most of them, are truly independent from their donor constituencies. It's also a fact that very vocally you have a number of governments, the US and the British government, also the French government, the German government, that grow increasingly irritated with humanitarian agencies that on the one hand are asking for a lot of money to do their job and on the other hand claim that they have to be totally independent and that they can be publicly critical of the policies, the military and the political actions that are undertaken by their very donor governments. Many people do think this is very irritating. What's interesting is that you have a number of even government agencies in large donor countries that have sort of grown apart from their own governmental structures and have become very critical of their own government policies. I understand that in the UK, for example, DFID, the humanitarian arm of the development arm of the British government, has a number of people that are actually basically very opposed to the Iraq intervention and are publicly saying so and are orienting the way that the British government is giving its funds to international organizations in a way that they give these funds to organizations that are pretty much critical of the British government and its interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if you look at the perception that beneficiaries have of neutrality and independence of international humanitarian organizations, you have to admit that it's pretty normal and it's understandable that These notions, these principles, as affirmed by international organizations, are not appearing as very credible, especially to Muslim fundamentalists, because what they're looking at, for example, is the way that we are talking about providing funds for humanitarian purposes. You have in the United States a government model that says you should have a faith-based charity. I know that it implies essentially to social giving within the United States and not necessarily for international aid, but the way it is perceived in Europe and also abroad is that there is a faith-based giving. There's a humanitarian action in the United States is a faith-based affair. And if you then equate that to, for example, the statement by President Bush that the United States was now waging a crusade against the terrorists, and if you look at references to the clash of civilizations that are cropping up often in governmental arguments that are concerning the global war on terror, Islamic organizations are extremely wary about the fact that we in Europe and we in the Western world, we should have faith-based charity, that governments should be providing funds to religious organizations, while their own system of charity, which is a religious-based system of charity, especially amongst the Shia Muslims, which is a very well organized, very sophisticated type of social safety network that they have traditionally, and that network is not being accepted by the Western world. We are actually looking in a very critical way at Islamic charitable organizations because we are saying that these organizations are abetting terrorism by channeling funds to organizations that we are considering as allies of the terrorist, of the fundamentalist networks. And what the Islamic organizations are saying that is that we have a tradition of giving by the church, by the mosque, by the religious organizations, by the imam, and that tradition should be as respected by the Western world as we should be respecting charitable giving by religious organizations that do receive also government funds. There is the accusation that we have now to compete amongst the humanitarian organizations with military funds. If you look at funding of humanitarian action, I'm not sure that we have to compete with military funding. What is certainly true is that there is in the areas that are affected especially by the global war on terror, namely now Afghanistan and Iraq, it's quite clear that it is the military, it's the Department of Defense, namely in Iraq, that is controlling where the funds are going, to what type of project they are going, whether funds are going either to security concerns or whether they are going to actual development or reconstruction projects. I think there's been a number of debates in the United States about whether this is right, that funds allocated actually to development and reconstruction for Iraq have then been used to provide security for contractors and for organizations that were actually working in reconstruction and development. But it certainly is true that if you look at the comparison of funding, the chairman of the World Bank has made a speech recently in Shanghai at a conference on poverty reduction, where he pointed out that $900 billion were used for defense purposes, $60 billion were used for official development aid by the OECD governments, by the Western governments, $5 billion were being used for humanitarian aid, and $300 billion were being used for agricultural subsidies in the Western world. And what he was saying very clearly was that this disequilibrium of expenditure between military expenditure, agricultural subsidy expenditure, and development aid and humanitarian aid, on the other hand, had to change if we had to make any impact on poverty reduction in the world. And now let's get to the legal issues, and I think these are the most important concerns today of humanitarian organizations. Humanitarian organizations and especially human rights activists are very concerned about two key issues. One is the fact that the United States, in particular, is saying that it can basically choose which treaty that it has ratified and signed, and it can choose what within what treaty it can actually apply by presidential decision in the case of a declared war. This is, I think, the War Powers Act that does allow the president to decide whether or not he wants to implement a given treaty and whether he wants to implement only part of a given treaty. And of course, when the treaties where the president can now choose whether he wants to apply them or not to apply them are the treaties that concern the waging of war, namely the Hague regulations on the conduct of hostilities, and when they concern international humanitarian law, the law that is basically providing for the protection of civilians in war, then I think there is reason for the international community, especially amongst human rights activists and humanitarian actors, to be worried. Because, secondly, there has been a memorandum given by Attorney General Ashcroft to the President of the United States. It was a memorandum that was debating whether or not international humanitarian law was actually applicable to prisoners made by the U.S. forces, by the Allied forces in Afghanistan. And in that memorandum, the Justice Department clearly argues that international law as such, namely the provisions that applied to the protection of prisoners, did not apply under the circumstances, and that basically there was a new type of law that had to apply, that had yet to be created. New regulations had to be produced in order to be applied to these prisoners that had been taken by the Allied forces in Afghanistan. As a result, you've had the Guantanamo issue, of course, and then the pretty large difficulties that the United States and the Allied forces have had in Iraq with the treatment of prisoners and with the attribution of specific statutes of prisoners and whether to choose whether they were now prisoners of war, whether they were just terrorists, whether they were war criminals, whether they were criminals of common law criminals, whether they had a special status as civilian internees. There's been a pretty huge confusion in Iraq, namely, as to who had what kind of status and what on what grounds. And that is certainly of a major concern to humanitarian organizations. What is happening now, in particular, is that the United States is saying that even though the occupation in Iraq, namely, has ended, it will continue to apply specific provisions of international humanitarian law to the conduct of warfare, and it will apply specific provisions to the treatment and the management of the prisoner population. In a way, it is reassuring because most of the provisions are currently being applied by the United States government and by the multinational force. But it's kind of strange in the sense that you have, on the one hand, a situation where you say that there is now a sovereign Iraqi government, that the occupation has ended, that there is now a government that is in power. That government has called for the intervention or for the staying of the multinational force to help it to establish law and order and to continue the fight against terrorist elements. And that is basically not a war. That is a, now that it, that has become a common law type of issue. And at this, by the same token, the U.S. government is saying that, yes, it will continue to apply international humanitarian law, namely Third Geneva Convention with respect to prisoners of war. But it's reassuring in a sense that also after that decision by the Supreme Court, I think there is a change now taking place within the opinion of U.S. lawmakers and government officials that, in fact, you have to apply a certain number of those provisions of international law, including to people that are now being held in Guantanamo. So there's one worrying thing that is certainly the major debating point for human rights activists and humanitarian activists. In the Geneva Conventions, there is one article, Article 3, that is common to all conventions. Now, the conventions deal with international law, international warfare. And that article stands out because it is sort of a summary of what some lawyers have called the public conscience. It says, it gives the no-nos in any circumstance, in any kind of war, including in civil wars, of what could not be done. It says very simple things. It says torture is prohibited. It says degrading and humiliating treatment of people is prohibited. It says taking of hostages is prohibited. It says extrajudicial executions are prohibited. It demands minimal judicial guarantees. It, it, It demands adequate treatment for wounded and sick people. And what you find in the memorandum of the Attorney General of the United States to the President is that the Attorney General is saying that this provision does not apply, is not applicable by the United States, and say because it is what they call customary law. It is not applicable if you say that these are international armed conflicts. It is applicable only if you look at the text in fine print. It is indeed applicable to conflicts of a non-international character. And therefore, the Attorney General argues it is not applicable to the situations in Iraq or Afghanistan, and therefore not to the prisoners. But if you look at what is being requested here of any warring faction, of any warring party, these are very simple, basic no-nos that these parties should respect. And I would have thought that if you do not agree with the notion of customary law, you don't want to be bound by customary law, that is law that you have not necessarily ratified, but that might be considered by international lawyers, by lawyer specialists, and by other governments as a law that is universally applicable, I think these are points where the United States government could very easily say, yes, we do abide by these points, and yes, we do want to apply that very article to the way that we are waging war and that we're treating prisoners and civilians in war. Now, the debate between whether this is now an issue of common law, of law enforcement, I mean the global war on terror and the legal aspects, that issue is still being debated. You have a lot of legal scholars that say that the law of war applies and it's an international armed conflict. Basically, what they're saying that is that there are many factors, especially the magnitude of the attacks that have been perpetrated on the United States, in the United States and abroad, that justify the fact that you cannot treat this kind of attacks as a law enforcement problem, but this is outright war. Condoleezza Rice has made a comment recently. She's saying it is a different kind of war, and we have to find new paradigms. We have to find another different type of legislation that would apply to that. And you have, on the other hand, people that will say that you cannot apply the laws of war to these to this type of conflict, because if you do that, and I'm quoting here, that if the United States accepted that it would only be the laws of war would be applicable. So these are the proponents of the common law approach. What they're saying that if they applied the laws of war, that would serve as a global waiver of domestic and international criminal and human rights law that regulate, if not prohibit, killing. And that would turn the whole world into a rhetorical battlefield that cannot legally justify, that would be a claimed license to kill people or detain them without recourse to judicial review anytime, anywhere. That's why they are saying that you should apply human rights law and you should apply criminal law and penal law in every state that is concerned. The debate is still on, as I said. What's interesting is that in Iraq, there is a group of lawyers that are attached to the multinational forces. It's called the Judge Advocate General's Office that is attached to the commanding officers of the multinational forces. And these people are drafting regulations that they're actually applying in Iraq to the way that they're managing their prison population. What rights do these prisoners have, as distinct from the rights that are provided for in international humanitarian law? How do they manage them? When do they get to go to trial? What sort of judicial guarantees do they have, and so on? And these are new regulations that are neither human rights law nor are they international humanitarian law. I don't know if these regulations are now public, but it would certainly be interesting to see what they're looking like. So let me conclude here with a few recommendations about what humanitarian actors in particular should be doing. I think we must take into account today that if we want to be neutral, independent and impartial within the context of the global war on terror, we have to make a huge effort to change the perception of the beneficiaries, not only but primarily in Muslim countries. We have to make a huge effort to steer clear of our alliance with donor governments and politically motivated constituencies. That will not be easy, and it will take time. It may mean that we will have to forego government funding and military protection in conflict zones if we want to be really distinct from the intervening forces. It may mean that we have to go back to the roots of providing essentially emergency assistance rather than branching out into reconstruction, development, peacemaking, conflict prevention, and so on. It may mean that we have to renounce the idea that we are, as representatives of an international civil society, better placed than governments or local institutions to foster actually conflict resolution and conflict prevention. And we may have, and we will have to foster really and truly the development and empowerment of national staff that is truly attached to the values that we defend and that is truly immersed in the context where they work. Because simply we are not able at this time to be operating as we used to be operating by sending in massive numbers of expatriate personnel to remedy a short-term emergency. If we want to work in areas affected by military operations within the global war on terror, we will have to accept that this is dangerous, and we will have to draw the necessary conclusions. We will either have to provide for our own private protection, and that will need the consent of warring parties. You cannot have a private security outfit today in Iraq without getting at least the approval of the multinational force and without making sure that the opposition, that the groups around Zarqawi and other people will not perceive this as another arm of the international coalition. And, or if we cannot do that, if we cannot provide for our own protection, then we will have to submit ourselves to the protection of the multinational forces. And we cannot expect today, I think it would be totally unreasonable to expect today that the intervening forces, let's say in Iraq, the multinational forces, will establish a humanitarian space for us and will provide us with arm's length type of security and will then look away from what we're doing. I think that is not conceivable. I think that from the time on that you do request security, you do request support, you will have to accept in a way that the multinational force and the civil administration that this multinational force has with it will contribute to telling you what you do and to define the scope of what the humanitarian action is. We cannot expect that we can claim for international intervention on humanitarian grounds, and then that we can continue simply to criticize the way that it is being provided. And if it is provided, and if the military actually do their job and assume their responsibilities of providing emergency humanitarian assistance, we may be moving towards not being too critical, and rather than being critical, cooperate in a better way, in a more open way, with the military so that they can do their job, especially when we are not able to perform it under the circumstances. I believe that we must use our strengths, not necessarily internationally by having large fora and by devising this international civil society. I think many human rights organizations should really focus on mobilizing support to modify legislation in their own country, to influence government decisions in their own country, rather than have this vast international activity. There is a very interesting French NGO. It's called the law against la raison d'état, law against raison d'état. And what it really promotes is, it says that NGOs in each of their own countries, what they should really be trying to do is to force their governments to comply with their international legal obligations, with their treaty obligations under international human rights law and under international law. And on the legal side, I believe that it is time that there is an open discussions about what type of law should be applying. And I think the resolution to the situation lies really with the United States taking the lead. I think the U.S. should be putting forward a utilitarian view in crafting new protocols to address armed conflict between states and non-state actors involved in terrorism. I think that if the U.S. had proposed this when it proposed that resolution 1373 on the 20th of September in 2001 that actually said that international terrorism was a threat against international peace and security, and that states that were attacked by international terrorism had a right to self-defense. If the U.S. at that time had proposed that there'd be a group of people sitting together within the UN and debate or establish a new kind of legislation that would cover the global war on terror, the relationship between states and these non-state terrorist actors, I think that would have been accepted. Now it may be a bit late because now there's a lot of opposition also to UN legislative efforts, and it's sort of gone by the wayside. I think that the states of the coalition in particular should lead the effort to find a common ground on how the new form of warfare should be governed in international law. Now, all these developments are very urgent, but they will all take time. And in the meantime, the humanitarian actors that are still on the ground and that bemoan the difficulties that they have to actually operate under current security constraints, they should maybe ponder a recommendation that was recently made by David Malone, a former ambassador of Canada to the United Nations and a current president of the International Peace Academy in New York. And he wrote an article on 1st of October in the Herald Tribune, International Herald Tribune, where he addresses specifically the United Nations. I want to read this to you because I'm basically very much in favor of what he's saying. He says, UN staffers, many of them highly dedicated and professional, and most of them prepared to take personal risks in the service of their ideals, need to get a grip. We don't need the UN in Denmark or Canada. We need it in difficult and often unsafe environments where absolute security cannot be achieved. This is part of the job, as is in the Foreign Service, non-governmental development and humanitarian organizations, and many private sector groups whose workers neither expect nor receive much recognition for the risks they run. While the UN needs to adopt better security precautions, its staffers are wrong to display unwanted self-regard and to invite pity for their plight. The UN needs to move on. Thank you very much.